Halton here. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop advanced safety equipment with performance and protection in perfect balance, like Globe Athletics, the latest innovation in turnout gear. Developed as athletic gear for firefighters, Athletics uses unique stretch fabrics that provide body contoured fit for unprecedented range of motion and flexibility. It's lighter weight, less bulky, and provides the protection you need from your turnout gear. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Hi, welcome to Fire Grand Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street with Anthony Avillo and Jim Duffy on Fire Engineering Talk Radio, where firefighters come to share their knowledge, their ideas, their opinions, and most of all, have a little bit of fun at the same time. So stay tuned and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Vibrant Strategies and all the stuff from this. Chief Avillo, are you there?
Yeah, you're cutting in and out now.
Yeah, I'm getting a big echo.
Yeah, all right. Are you getting me on an echo?
No, you're just fine.
Okay, no, you're good now. You're good now, but you were cutting out before.
Okay. So again, welcome to September's Fire Grand Strategy and Other Stuff from the Street.
Yeah, like Bobby Halton said, we're very, very grateful for Globe MSA Safety Athletics. Give them a look. It's in the chat group. It'll give you a website you can look at. We're very grateful to them. We wouldn't be having this time on the air with you folks and discuss your thoughts and opinions if it wasn't for people like Globe MSA Safety. So thank you to them. And again, welcome to September's edition of Fireground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street. Talk about one of our favorite subjects tonight. We're going to talk about size up, but a broader subject than we typically do. We usually talk about structure fires. So we're going to talk how do you size up a hazmat incident, a medical incident, wildland. We have Casey McCoy joining us tonight, and he's going to give some of his expertise. And themes of violence and COVID, how that all plays into your initial size up of things. Chief Avillo, number one, before we move on to the subject, how you doing?
I'm good, man. I can't believe the summer's over. It's crazy.
Yeah. Summer's never over.
Yeah, I guess not. But you know what? Over the last, like, couple of weeks, the water in the bay has been getting progressively chillier and thing, man. Especially when you look at, you know, what's going on and, you know, how many freedoms we actually going to have now, the cooler weather's coming. So don't know.
Yeah.
All I know is had a great summer on our boat, and now it's, almost over. But
good. How's the academy going?
Academy's going good. We're running a fire one, fire two combo. We are running a rescheduled fire two from the spring, and we're starting another fire two in October. Doing a little bit of fire police, some incident command, but not a real lot because we only can utilize one room in the academy and social distance properly. We have a 225-seat auditorium, and we can bring 40 people into that auditorium. All the other classrooms are like, 10, 15 people. So we've decided that only one classroom will be used per night, disinfected the next day. And, that's what we're doing. So it's good. We're hoping that, everybody stays healthy. We're taking temperatures. And, we have One of my instructors came down with COVID, but he hadn't been at the academy in 2 weeks, which was good. And so far, none of the students have that we know of. So we're you know, going to move forward as best we can.
That's me calling Casey. So,
oh, okay.
So, yeah, he's been dropped a couple times, so I'm going to try to get him back.
Okay.
So, anyway, we have a guest with us tonight, hopefully. We're having a little technical difficulty. But we're Casey McCoy. He works in the wildlands sector. And since both Anthony and I have been structural firefighters our entire careers, we figured bringing his expertise in would help us a lot. Oh, well, that's not working.
No. Now, Casey's where? He was in Nebraska, wasn't he? Where is he now?
Yes, he was. All right, I'm going to see if I can fix this, guys. I apologize.
Okay. Yeah, we're having some technical difficulties tonight on the platform here, so we'll, you know, we're just trying to get it fixed. I have absolutely no idea how to fix anything, so I'm glad I got Duffy here. And, you know, he may only have a little bit of an idea how to fix stuff, but.
yep, and so, they let me be in charge.
And he's in charge. Listen, I love that.
I don't mean now. I meant before I retired. They let me be in charge of a shift.
Followed you.
Yeah. I think we would have followed each other. That, you know, there's the blind leading the blind for sure.
Yeah,
but we had
okay.
fun. But we had fun. Casey, if you're listening, try giving a call back. It didn't seem to work when I tried calling you. Give it one more shot. I think I got him. Casey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm on now.
Hey.
Wow, we're having some technical difficulties tonight, so I apologize. Thanks for calling in. Chief Avila wants to say hello to you.
Hey, Case. What's up, brother?
Hey, not too much. How are you guys doing?
We're good. How are you doing out there?
Oh, it's doing okay. It's a little bit like Groundhog Day, the movie, but and I think I'm Bill Murray, but going pretty good.
Good. Well, Casey, a lot of our listeners don't know you, and I don't want to screw up your title and your job functions, but we called you to join us tonight for your expertise because we're going to be doing a lot about size-ups. But Chief Avila and I, neither one of us know a lot about what you do in wildland, so we figured we could get some help from you. So why don't you introduce yourself, tell us what you do, who you work for, and all that good stuff.
Right, thanks. Well, I'm now the Fire Prevention Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Been in this position now for about 3, give or take, years, located in St. Paul, Minnesota, although I haven't been to that office much for a while. But prior to that, I was in Nebraska for 10 years where I met these two great guys. And I was the training officer there for the State Forest Service. And then before that, I've been in a few other states. I've been, you know, with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management out in Oregon on fires. I was in Kansas for 5 years. And then also up in, just the east here over in Wisconsin with the Wisconsin DNR when I was going to college. So it's we've been mobile. That's what everybody tells me. The M in the name stands for mobile.
You're talking about the east. No, we're in the east.
It's all
you can't get much
right.
More east than Avila and I.
No, definitely not. So, are they having wildland issues in Minnesota?
We have not, and I'm doing as I say that I'm knocking on wood. We had a maybe thankfully we had a pretty kind of run-of-the-mill spring fire season. We have kind of a split season up here. In Wisconsin, a lot of these states around here have that same thing. We have a fire season that starts as soon as the snow melts and until everything greens up. And in a typical year, we kind of slow down maybe a few nuisance runs here and there across the state. And then after we start getting those freezes in the fall again, then you start seeing fire behavior pick back up. This spring wasn't a great deal of stuff. or nothing out of the ordinary, nothing to write home about anyway. But who knows? We've, as you look back through Minnesota's history, you can see a lot of a number of the large, well, for lack of a better term, impressive wildfires have happened in the fall. So there's always that. It's typically not as big of a fire season, but that doesn't mean we can't have something. We have a bit of a challenge up here in that, you know, now I'm focused on, you know, primarily not so much operational anymore, but now doing fire prevention and FireWise. So trying to get people to do their own thing around their own structures so that fire folks can concentrate on putting the fire out, not necessarily protecting the structures. And we have it's a challenge up here because we don't have, you know, we don't have the big seasons every year in and year out like they do in other states. We have snow 6 months out of the year. And so it's double tough trying to get people to recognize that there will be times when if you have the fuels around you, there's going to be a time that your house is probably going to be threatened. So the best time to do things about it is right now, to minimize that. So
great advice. Great advice. Hey, I was going to be out your way. I was going to be teaching at the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Conference, but that got canceled. So I was kind of disappointed. I was going to see all the folks from out that way, you know, you, Becky, and a few other people. That would have been great. But you know what? I'm okay with it. You know, I'm not too overly upset. I wasn't thrilled about heading out to some areas, you know, with all the violence and stuff going on at the airports and in the cities in your area of the world.
Yeah, it's been interesting. We are about, 15 or 20 miles away from kind of the edge of where some of that's happened. So it's been, it's made your radar go up a little bit anyway.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. But anyway, like you know, and we might as well start with you now that you've just introduced yourself. You know, all the different disciplines, you know, like I said earlier, hazmat, medicals, wildland, scenes of violence, and of course, structure fires, both taxpayers, multiple dwellings, private dwellings, and high rises. They're all a little bit different. Tell me what, when you obviously, it's more in an ICS system that you guys do, incident management, than we would do in a size up, because a single engine company with three people on it is going to be doing initial size up. But usually with wildland, it's much bigger and more involved than that, I'm assuming. Help me out if I'm wrong.
Well, it kind of depends. You know, you think about it from, you know, there 90-plus percent of the wildfires that a lot of people go on, they stay at that something less than 10 acres. So a lot of times when, you know, a wildland firefighter is rolling up on an incident, it might be just one engine with three people on it, and getting that initial picture to send to a dispatch center, most likely, and, you know, either, you know, say we can handle it or request more resources or that kind of thing. And, you know, as things get bigger, you know, like you see all over the news right now, then you still have kind of a local, you know, your piece of the puzzle, your piece of the pie size up that you'd be working on. And so you'd still be, you know, as you get sent into a new area, especially, there may be, you know, quite a few maps and things that exist for that fire already, but the resources that are getting sent to that area, literally maybe from four or five states away, we've sent, from here in Minnesota, we've sent some resources to the West Coast, and they just sent some structural engines to the West Coast today, actually, or I think they're leaving, either left today or they're leaving tomorrow to go out there to Oregon and help with that. So still a good need for that size up to figure out, you know, where are the hazards, what do you have, where are the fallback places that you can perhaps move back to if you have to, what resources are next to you. Always looking for new places to, you know, if you have to move quickly, if the fire changes on you, which is always on your mind, or you hope it's always on people's mind anyway, where do we need to back off to? Where can we set up a or recognize a new safety zone, and how are we going to get there? Those kind of things. And I don't know if I quite answered what you were looking for there, but I think it's pretty similar. It's just the different things that you might be focused on being outside versus having a relatively, I'm doing the air quote thing, a relatively contained area in the structure.
Yeah, I think you really kind of laid it down on, like, you know, made the major differences there. You know, when you're inside, you can somewhat control the environment. Well, you hope. You hope we're controlling the environment. And the outside, you have that, you know, that wind and that weather and topography and all that other stuff that, you know, I guess you really, really have to take into consideration. Because if you look at how you know, firefighters die in this wildland environment, it's usually one of two ways, right? They're either, you know, overrun by a fire that has made a move that they weren't considering or didn't size up properly for, or the other one, the big one, is the MVAs that go on out there. You know, so I think it's a different ball game. You know, we have the Meadowlands by us, and that's the only, like, sort of wild end area that we have. But when it gets windy down there, and you know, if there's railroad tracks that run through it, there's obviously, you know, bodies buried out there. all the big power line towers are there, you know, and I've seen the fires just, like, you know, spin around in an instant. And, you know, when they looked a little sort of like they were going to be, like, you know, contained, and all of a sudden they're burning in the opposite direction, you know. And I could just imagine how the, and for us, you know, we have to deal with the structures that we have as exposures. But, you know, in those environments, I just imagine, like, how fast, you know, that shit moves, you know. And, you know, it's just an interesting dynamic to deal with that. But it's something I always wanted to do, to be honest with you. But I, you know, just never got a chance to get out there and do it.
When I wore a younger man's clothes, I would have wanted to do it. Today, you know, it's like backpacking and putting out fires at the same time. Casey, let me ask you a little bit about the red card system, because it's starting to drift into structural firefighting too, based on, it's called the blue card, but it's based, instant command system is based on what you guys have been doing, I'm going to say, at least 20 plus years.
Yeah. I'm a real, you know, fan of the red card system. It's, you know, it's based on an identified set of courses that a person has to take, that anyone would have to take that wants to get to that level of credential or certification, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it. And with almost every position, there is also affiliated with that, the courses that you're required to take. There's also what's called a position task book. And that position task book lays out a variety of, you know, just what it sounds like. It's a variety of tasks that you have to perform under the supervision of a person who's already qualified at that level or higher. Higher is, they've changed that to an extent to, it can't, you're not going to have a type one incident commander being a, you know, that's the top of the heap essentially of ICs. You're not going to have them supervising and reviewing someone who's trying for the firefighter type one, which is the other end of the spectrum more or less, because the rule of thumb there is the last time that the type one IC was a squad boss, a firefighter type one, may have been many, many years ago. So it's, there's kind of a time frame, so to speak, in there as well. So within the task book, there are some of the tasks that can be accomplished in the classroom, some of the tasks that need to be on an incident, and that's any kind of an incident, so any kind of a planned event that's operating under ICS. And then there are some of the assignments that are some of the tasks that are required that you actually perform them on a wildfire. And so there's no minimum number of fires that a person has to go on. Kind of the unwritten rule is, you know, it's got to be at least more than one. Getting one assignment with all those tasks lined up in that book for you to perfectly do under someone's supervision and do them right the first time, that's rare. And I would say almost never. But there's no specific minimum. There's no specific maximum. So it is, I would admit, a little subjective based on who's doing the evaluation. But in general, if you have multiple different evaluators in a task book, that final evaluator can take into account the evaluations that have been done already and choose to sign you off. And it's reviewed one more time after that, usually at least one more time. And so when you've got the tasks completed and the certain tasks in a certain task book and the classes that are required for it as well, then you are given that next level, that next credential, that next certification. Mm-hmm. So it is involved, and it can take some time, but it's also a pretty solid system.
Cool. I like that. I want to get a little bit to size up. So say you're whatever it is, a captain on an engine company or a regional leader coming into an area, and you've got, you know, maybe a couple hundred acres fire starting or been burning for a couple of days and you're one of the later reasons. What kind of information do you need to get back to the state level or BLM or regional or wherever that goes? What kind of information would they want from the people with feet on the ground? I'm excluding, obviously, aircraft, but the people with the feet on the ground, what kind of information do they need to collect as part of their size up to get back to the higher ups that are going to decide what resources are coming later?
Right. Well, they would be, again, kind of a subjective look at it, but they're going to be using their experience to decide, you know, do we have enough on hand? Can we handle it with the resources? Do we feel we can handle it with the resources that we have on hand? Or what other resources do we need? Ideally, and this might be maybe not on the first time you rolled up on an incident, but over time you would start to develop a picture of, you know, not just what's burning right now, but what might be burning tomorrow. You know, thinking
right
ahead about what is here right in front of us and what are we hoping to do. I mean, that's the goal, right, is to capture it right where it's at, to keep it to the smallest possible footprint as you can. But there's always that piece in the back of your mind, what's the contingency? What could we fall back to if we had to, and what's in between where we are and where that is right now? You're always balancing, or maybe not balancing, you're always kind of comparing or contrasting, you know, the weather forecast, weather forecasting is just, it has gone so much, it's so much better than it used to be. I mean, it's down to where they can predict, you know, within maybe 30 or 45 minutes of when a cold front is going to go through an area, they can predict when it's going to reach your piece of the fire, which is just amazing. And if you guys aren't familiar with cold fronts are something that should raise your radar, because that's going to switch your wind 180 degrees the other direction ish. It's going to switch your wind pretty severely. So always something that gets attention anyway, when you hear that word, those two words thrown around the fire line.
I guess they must be much better at predicting weather out there, because they can't predict weather for crap in New Jersey.
That's because you don't care about Jersey.
Touché.
I can tell you that the Weather Channel's forecasts have gotten me wet on the motorcycle more times than I care to mention, but I wouldn't use the Weather Channel forecast on a wildfire, so.
Mm-hmm. No, I imagine you wouldn't. So, like, where are you in Minnesota now, or are you deployed somewhere?
Nope, I'm in Minnesota. Let me say, my position's more, I guess I've gone to more of the administrative side of things, so we focus mostly on the fire prevention and FireWise side of things right now. There are probably opportunities to go out. I'm as a trainee on one of our internal Type 3 incident management teams. Those are building as we speak, and I think our one in-state incident commander, I believe he is out, I'm not sure which state he's in, but I believe he's out west on one of the eastern area teams right now.
Okay.
Wow.
I was in – go ahead, Duff, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I was listening to you describe, like, where the fire is going to be tomorrow. It would be like me standing in front of, a row of 10 taxpayers in any downtown area, and I have a fire in the center store. And as I'm sitting there, can I keep this at one alarm, or do you need to call two or three alarms predicting where it's going to go? Is it going to just remain in? Can you keep it contained to that single store or occupancy, or is it going to move down the whole block? You know, we can begin very quickly by getting into the store, one down, pulling ceilings. And if you look up in the ceiling, you have fire rolling above you. You're going to need maybe a second or third alarm because we might eventually end up losing the whole block of storefront. So it sounds, trying to compare what I have done to what you described, it sounds very similar, but I'm talking minutes and hours where you're talking days and weeks and maybe months sometimes.
Yeah. Maybe months, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I always compared. I mean, I've been in. I started as a volunteer firefighter in my hometown, so I've got some crossover being on, you know, more structural oriented fire departments as well. Of course, you know, volunteers are they, whatever it is, whatever they get the call for, that's what they're going to do.
Yep.
But I always kind of compared the two of them together as being, at least in my own head, the way I have it rationalized, maybe in my own head is you know the guys that do. There are a lot of similarities between wildland and structural. They're not the same, but there's a ton of similarities. And I think I always viewed a structure fire as more of the sprint as compared to a wildland fire was more of an endurance race where you were maybe not going at quite the level of physical output, although it's not easy. Neither of them is easy. But you're just doing it over maybe a slower pace for a longer period of time.
That's a great
former fire chief now. Oh, go ahead.
It's a great analogy, the sprint compared to the marathon. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, we you guys know Mr. Cutler from Nebraska. We were always going to. We always threatened that we were going to put our heads together and come up with a class proposal for FDIC on how the two sides of the coin, so to speak, about how wildland and structure firefighting are parallel and then where they kind of diverge off. But we just never figured out what the hook was going to be on a class like that. So.
Yeah, that
Nebraska, they have a lot of grassland fires, right?
Yep.
I was going to say the same thing, though.
Yeah, I know that they, you know, they're not heavily forested or a lot of high terrain, but some of those grass fires and the cornfields, from what I've read and tried to understand, can get pretty devastating and very quick moving.
Yeah. There was a fire in 1999, and it's right in the middle of Nebraska, more or less, a little town called Thedford. And that fire was in, I believe, if I remember right, I'm kind of pulling the Wayback Machine out here, March of that year, if I remember right.
That's great.
And that fire went in 12 hours. It burned 72,000 acres.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just, you know, that's with a 40 or 50 mile an hour wind behind it. And your attack goes from, you know, you're trying to run a bunch of trucks that have maybe 300 gallons of water on them that are spraying 50 or 60 gallons a minute, maybe. And your pattern just can't possibly be wide enough and have enough, you know, suppression power to extinguish a fire line that's, you know, 40, 50, 60 feet wide or deep, you know, because the wind's got it bent over so far. By the time you suppress one side of it, it's moved, you know, another 50 yards away from you. It's
wow.
And they don't get, I mean, not to negate what the folks out on the West Coast are dealing with. That is an equally nasty animal that they're fighting with out there right now. But the grassland fires, in my obviously biased opinion, a lot of times don't get the real respect that they should get. And I don't mean that, you know, in a thump your chest kind of that kind of respect way, but I think sometimes, you know, I think about those guys in those little fire departments in Nebraska that have perhaps, you know, their experience over 5 or 10 years on the fire department, they've never had that fire. You know, I'm doing the air quote thing, that fire, that one that's going to be the eye-opening kind. And so you try to apply the same tactics of the 10-acre fire to the 5,000 or 10,000-acre fire
And that's where things kind of go south on you a little bit. So you try to do the same things. You're using your experience, right? You're using that level of experience to tackle that monster that you don't know. And that's where things kind of get south.
Yeah, you get complacent. And, we fought this fire last week. We fought a fire almost like this last week. And it's like the towns, much like the towns that I worked in, most of our work was private dwelling fires. And when you try to use private dwelling fires in a commercial structure or a large, 10-story or 15-story multiple dwelling, it doesn't work. But you always went in with your 1 3/4 line and you knocked down the room and contents fire in a private dwelling, and then you're in a huge structure. So it sounds very, very similar that the small volunteer departments you talk about in Nebraska, not necessarily volunteer, but smaller departments,
right.
They fought the small grass fire, the small fire on a farm, dozens of times over their 20-year career, with 5, 12, maybe 15-mile-an-hour winds. And you're talking a 40-mile-an-hour wind in, I'm going to probably say, early spring or late fall when everything's dry. And, there's the similarity we were just talking about between the two disciplines.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, with the grass, when it's really dry, I mean, that stuff's got to take off like lint in a dryer, That's pretty crazy. In case you don't think I didn't recognize the Mr. Peabody and Sherman reference there, I was very impressed with that.
Casey, you're not old enough.
Who, me?
No, you are, but Casey's not.
But that was a great reference, man. I was like, wow.
The Wayback Machine.
And the Wayback Machine. And his pet dog, his pet boy Sherman. My goodness.
Yep.
Yeah, so I imagine the tactics in one area, applied in, incorrectly or, just not recognizing the potential could create the same type of situation you run into if you're trying to fight a 500,000 square foot warehouse with a pre-connect.
Yeah, I got to agree with you on that, and it's pretty common, those kind of things. It's just like people saying, "I'm not leaving." I've weathered hurricanes before. Yeah, well, this is a Category 4 hurricane coming. You've not weathered, a Category 4 hurricane at high tide,
yeah.
And people stay, and then they dial 911 looking for help. Well, you underestimated what was coming, and you're kind of stuck because nobody can come. And I'm sure the same thing happens in these wildland situations where people want to stay and protect their homes with garden hoses, and you have the fury of, a fire that's creating its own weather and its own wind coming at your home. And it's pretty scary stuff. That's got to be frightening.
That's got to really be frightening. Have you ever been in a situation, Casey, that, was beyond your expectation when dealing with something like that and had a close call?
Oh, yeah. And mostly a lot of those, I would say, were when I first started in my career in the fire service. There were times I still remember being in the cab of the truck with a very longtime firefighter, and his instructions to me were to keep looking out, for any kind of hazards that we might run into as we're going through just smoke that was so thick I couldn't see the end of the hood.
Wow.
That's one of those points where you kind of go, okay, this is, the fire I was on the week before was maybe half an acre, and we scratched a little line around it, and we were done with it in an hour or two. And this one was just, it was an eye opener. I still remember
that.
Shit
got real.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I say that fire though, that was what, as scary as that was there for a while, that's what set the hook in me going down the path of being a wildland firefighter.
That's interesting. That's great. Well, I'm going to give you my very limited experience in wildland firefighting or brush fires. I won't even call it wild. Trains came through where I started as a volunteer on Long Island, and the sparks would set the brush along the side of the road.
Yep.
We get dispatched to brush fires. So many years later, my brother-in-law became a volunteer out on eastern Long Island, and they have what they call the Pine Barrens, which is the scrub pines and the scrub oak. So Maureen's sister calls and goes, "Hey, Keith just went on a fire, a brush fire." And he goes, "Ah, don't worry, he'll be back in an hour, maybe 2 hours at the most. He'll be back." Well, 4 days later, he came back because the Pine Barrens, you know, it was jumping six-lane highways. Not like it's going on the west, but it's a very volatile fuel, you know. And actually, those pine trees do not let their seeds out unless they're exposed to fire. So it's kind of interesting. It's in the sand, but the trees are maybe at the most like 8 feet tall, but it goes for miles and miles and miles. And so it's 40 miles apart where I lived in suburbia. He was out there looking at that, and it was a whole different world. So, yeah, I have very limited experience with any kind of brush fires. We have some rail trails and some hiking trails on some mountains and state parks on the edge, but nothing to speak of, obviously, what's going on out west or what you've been involved in, Casey. You know, so kudos to all you guys. It's maybe because of my lack of knowledge, but I think what the hours and hours and days that get put into these and the strike teams and the task force that you guys can assemble when needed always amazes me.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting when, you know, the Wildland Fire Service, you'll talk to, I still remember when I took, I'm sure you guys are most likely taking the stuff out there or have taken stuff out there as well, the 300 and 400 level incident command courses that everybody's, you know, required to take now, more or less.
Right.
Yep.
The guy who taught me the course, which was just, you know, was one of those instructors that you just would love to just sit and just listen to them for days on end. It made the class so much better because it could have been much worse.
Yeah.
In ICS class. So there's that. But the reason it was so good was because, I mean, the guy started his career in Colorado as a wildland firefighter and became,
wow,
you know, an incident commander, a type 2 incident commander. But a lot of the stories that he shared a number of stories from working hurricanes in Texas. And then he was also, and I don't remember exactly what he did, but he was also in New York on 9/11 and ran a piece of that incident out there as well. And so in addition to all the wildland firefighting stories he could tell, he could also pull one of those out of his hat about, well, what the heck was it? He dealt with an evacuation center, I believe it was for Hurricane Katrina, and he had to deal with things that he never dealt with before as a wildland IC, like you know, drug rings setting up inside of his evacuation center that he was in charge of. So just the variety of things they've dealt with. The odd thing, or maybe the continuous string between all of them, was the fact that they used ICS regardless of what the issue was. They used ICS to manage their way through it. It's just a system of organization that on the wildfire side is very familiar and comfortable.
Yep, parks is parks.
Yeah.
You know, it's and that all came out of FireScope, if I remember correctly.
Yep, I think you're right.
You
out
know,
of California.
Yep. FireScope, and then Alan Brunicini added his parts to it. And I think we're a better fire service because of it. I know there are many organizations that are still having difficulty with it. But position, whatever kind of fire or what hurricane, like you were just talking about, the incident, you're managing teams and groups. Just make sure the people you have in charge of those groups know what they're doing, and you can move the pieces around like a chess game, you know, and it works pretty well. I think in most cases, not in all cases, there's a lot to be said for instinct and your gut feelings too, in a lot of things. The longer you've been doing something, the better you get at it. It's not all in the book.
No, I think that's maybe also why it gets a little bit, when you hear those horror stories about an incident command system gone wrong, I think that might play into it as well, is that you've got maybe people in positions that only have the book side of it, but don't have the think side, the experience side of it, and that don't recognize that sometimes you have to color outside the lines a little bit too.
Yeah, it doesn't all fit always.
Yeah, that's a good analogy to coloring outside the lines. That's, you know, it's the ICS is about, you know, it's organize your operation and then figure out, you know, where you're at. And you're right, you sometimes got to color outside the lines. I like, man, you're like a wealth of like just throwing shit out there tonight, bro.
Yeah. Watch me next week. I'll be on Jeopardy. Lots of useless tidbits of information.
There you go.
I want you to guys know that I'm giving up the first night Jeopardy's back on since this whole COVID thing started. I had my Jeopardy is one of my favorite shows, and I'm missing it tonight to chat with you guys. The first time they're back, February, I guess, or even before that, because I think they were doing reruns a little bit anyway. So.
Alex Trebek is there?
He's still there. He's doing okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That guy's an icon.
God bless him. Yep.
That's really cool.
So,
I didn't know that.
Yep. So I want to drift into a couple other subjects on Size Up. And one thing I want to talk about that I don't have too much experience on, but I have dealt with it many times in my career, especially when I worked on an ambulance or on an engine company, showing up to scenes of violence. And these things, I think all are called today going on in the country. We have to move looking out and making sure the scene is safe. I know that's an EMT thing, make sure the scene is safe. But I think we have to proceed to everything you could be a potential target. I think we need to open our eyes, look what's going on. Even though you go into a structure fire, is someone there who wants to hurt you? Someone who wants to hurt your crews? We have to look for it. I know Steve Hamilton does a great class on looking for that kind of stuff. I don't have all the answers, but I think we need to be more aware before even what's going on with the building, especially in certain sections of the country or your city. Not only is it what's on fire, what kind of construction been going on in this neighborhood for the last 2 months? Are they throwing Molotov cocktails? Are they attacking the police? Are they attacking firefighters? So know your neighborhoods, know your district. Is this an area where you have a fire? Could it be a trap? Maybe it's not a trap, but you're showing up and they wanted to burn down a building and they want to stop you from putting out that fire. So I think we need to put that on our list of Size Up, not just, Norman 13 points of Size Up, building size, all of that stuff. But we need to move that to the front, and it's unfortunate, but it's where we are today. If you live in Portland or Minneapolis or Seattle or LA, you might
anywhere,
want to move that
really
up on your list. Say again?
Anywhere, really. Listen, you know what? A lot of the places where, the violence just like breaks out are sometimes places that, one, you never expected it to happen, or places where you never even heard of the place.
Yep.
It could happen anywhere.
You know, I'm sorry that it's something that I feel I have to talk about, but it's very, very real. In Wallingford, where I just retired from, there have been protests, but they've all been very, very peaceful. I am proud to say that, I have no problems with anybody protesting, but people attacking police officers, throwing Molotov cocktails, in Rochester and Buffalo jumping on fire trucks, throwing rocks and bottles at the firefighters responding to structure fires. So to move that up in the front of our list. And I think that's important on everything. Hazmat incidents as well. Is this hazmat incident, you know, they always say isolate and deny entry. Yes, start there, and we may have to start there at fires too. You know, find out what's going on. But is this hazmat incident an act of terrorism? Is this, you know, American-born terrorism? Is it people who want to just hurt us? I don't know. I don't have all the answers. But I think we need to open our eyes a little more for that kind of thing. What do you think, guys?
Go ahead, Casey.
Well, I've
Casey,
been.
Casey, you there?
Been,
I didn't know. Yeah. About that, yeah.
Yeah. I have maybe had the fortune of not necessarily having to deal with that side of it very much, but I think that's an unfortunate sign of the times, I guess. I guess it's part of, you know, we always used to say, again, I go back to what I'm most familiar with is being in on the wildland side about having your head on a swivel at all times. And that almost gets to be a little bit of a cliche statement, so to speak, because you can say it, you can check that box, but there's kind of a difference between, you know, seeing it and seeing it, if that makes any sense, that to keep your eyes up for things like that, just knowing what the climate, so to speak, is right now, and being aware that those things could happen, and then maybe even war gaming, so to speak. I hate that term; it's been used way too much lately. But predicting, planning, what if this happens, then I'm going to do this. Maybe have to deal with it quite as much in the on the wildfire side of things, but it's always something to be aware of. You never know. I've had friends who talked about they're working down in southeastern U.S. around folks who are not necessarily fond of not just firefighters, but just anyone with a government license plate on the rig that they're driving, and mm-hmm. being shot at on wildfires. Going into rural areas where there were, you know, things like patches of marijuana growing and then finding booby traps for anybody that came through the area. So those kind of things were, you know, cut along that same lines of things that we had to always be aware of.
Mm. Yeah. You know what? All of this isn't new at the level it is. It's new. I'm going to tell you a little war story. Back in 1990-something, I don't know, I was working on the ambulance that day. And we get dispatched to a domestic, stage until the police secure the scene. So my partner turns into the parking lot. It was a 5-story multiple dwelling. He turns into the parking lot of the building. So that's not really staging. We should have been 2 blocks away. But we turn into the parking lot, and you hear domestic. So you assume that it's a man beating up a woman. So here comes a girl, comes running out of the building. So my partner invites this girl into our ambulance. He's going to be the hero and protect this girl. So she gets in the back of the ambulance. She's got a folded up newspaper in her hand. And he goes back to evaluate. And inside that newspaper was a 9mm weapon. And she dumped like an 8-ball of cocaine in the back of the ambulance. So I'm like, yeah, thanks, Joe. But but there are scenes of violence. You know, this stuff has always been happening, but they've been ones and twos at a time. But now there's hundreds of people with Molotov cocktails and other weapons, ball bearings, government people. And you know what? Like it or not, we're government employees.
Yeah.
But I think... you know, people are worried about COVID. I take precautions with COVID. You know, I wear a mask when I go to Home Depot or Stop and Shop or whatever. But what I'm more worried about, I have a ton of family in New York. I go over to Throgs Neck Bridge to get there. They closed the George Washington Bridge today for about an hour and a half. you know, what happens if I show up, me and my wife, we're on a bridge, and this is all going on. Now I'm in my private vehicle, you know. So that's what I personally worry about more than COVID. I mean, although I have a healthy respect for COVID, but now you're on a fire truck and you're responding to that scene on the George Washington Bridge, the Throgs Neck Bridge. You're the enemy. You know?
Oh, yeah. What did they have a protest on there today, Beth?
Yeah, they had a protest on there on the New York side. They closed one of the exits, you know, going into Washington Heights. You know,
okay. I think there was one yesterday, too, right on the bridge.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So I can tell you, and I'll go back probably 6 or 8 years ago. There were protests about going on, and I was the shift commander, and the ambulance calls me, and they got a critical patient in the back of the ambulance, and the protesters have Route 34 and 91 closed going to Yale New Haven Hospital, the closest level one trauma center. And they're stuck, and they're calling me, asking me what to do. I'm like, you know what? I'll get the state police there as soon as I can. But, you know, but they closed the routes to the hospital in protest, you know. So even though they weren't violent, but there was hundreds and hundreds of them, so the ambulance couldn't get to Yale Hospital, you know. So... And I think that's becoming more and more common, too. What are your two-man medic crews on an ambulance? What do they do? How safe are they out there? What do we do to protect them? What do we teach them so they don't get stuck in this kind of problem? Any ideas?
I don't know. I would think, you know, just ensure that, you know, keep yourself safe, stay inside the vehicle, contact the police, but, you know, that might not even be enough. What do you do when you're right in that situation and, you know, they could be all around you, you know?
And you have a critical patient in the back of your ambulance. So you're a paramedic in the ambulance, and the person back there is having the big MI or the big stroke, and you're actually a mile from the hospital, and you can't get there.
Yeah, what do you do? You ram your way through. Now you're going to be – go ahead, man.
Yeah. No, but paramedics have so many skills. In Connecticut, they're not carrying thrombolytics, you know, no TPA, nothing to dissolve clots. You know, you have some drugs. You have a defibrillator. And, you know, I just can't even imagine the stress level of the paramedics and the EMTs trying to deal with this. And how soon can the police get there? How effective are the police going to be? Because, you know, depending on how violent the crowd is, we've been very lucky in Connecticut. They have not been – all the protests have been peaceful, but they have blocked roads, locked entrances to facilities, but so far there has not been any extreme violence. But who's to say that's not going to happen? So that's something we have to start, like I said, moving to the top of our size up list. And again, like I said before, I'm sorry to have to say that.
Yeah, it's a tough situation, you know.
Yep, I'm glad I'm retired.
Yeah,
you know what? I miss the heck out of it. Don't misunderstand me. But you know what? This year, I'm glad I'm not the shift commander in the fire department. I'm pretty happy to be sitting on my deck talking to you guys.
Yeah, a lot going on that you know, we just, you know, have never really dealt with before, you know, in – you know, even in suburban areas. I mean, where you are, Duff, that's, you know, that's a relatively suburban area in comparison to, you know, places that you normally expect these types of things to occur, you know?
Yep.
I don't know.
Yeah. And,
does anybody have any policy on that, you know?
Well, we've discussed it before even I retired, and not because of what's going on today. I'm sure today they have a lot. Like, you know, we're supposed to stage to the scene safe with police and all of that. But the reality is, when it really happens, you know, the police make bad calls. I've had my medics invited into a home where the threat was still holding a weapon when the paramedics went into the house. You know, they were actually using the ambulance as a way to coax the guy to come out of the house and go into the back of the ambulance. But they never informed the command, and it was command, was just a lieutenant on an engine, but
right,
that this was happening. And they walk a guy into the back of their ambulance who's still carrying, you know. So mistakes of communication between the police and the fire department is very, very common. They view the world differently than we do. We're carrying saline, a defibrillator, and a first aid kit. You know, when you have that welcomed into your ambulance, it's a surprise. Or an engine goes and shows up on a CO call, and it turns out to be someone attempting suicide, you know, and then they're fighting you off when you go in and try to help them. You know, those are always surprises.
Yeah.
So it happens. I'm getting way too deep in this violent thing.
What's that?
I said I'm getting way too deep into this violence thing, but it's very real, and I think we as firefighters need to pay attention.
Yeah, it's definitely a reality that, unfortunately, you find yourself right in the middle of it. And you know, when you didn't expect it, you know, you find yourself right in the middle of it, and now what do you do? You know.
Yep.
I don't know. You know.
Look in Portland. Every fire in Portland is—I won't say every fire, but most fires in Portland today—they're arson. Seattle, arson. You know.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty crazy. Go ahead, Anthony.
We had a gang fire one time. It was up in West New York, and they torched an occupied building. And we got there, there were fights in the street. They were fighting each other. They were fighting the police. There were people on the fire escape. It was, you know, like it was friggin' crazy, you know. And you know, you pull up on something like that, and you're like, you know, stuck right in the middle of it, you know. And now you know your command post is on the corner, and you're hoping that, you know, your command post is safe, because, you know, sometimes the initiation into those things is take out a first responder. You know, yeah, this was quite a long time ago, and I really didn't even know about that type, you know, didn't know that much about it. And, you know, all of a sudden, here we are, we pull up, this building is friggin' roaring, there's people all over the fire escape, and there's...
And you're in charge.
Riot. Yeah, there's a riot going on in the street. And yeah, it was crazy.
Do you remember West Webster, New York? I'm going to say probably maybe 8-9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Guy lit his house on fire. Small volunteer department, maybe total membership is 30 members.
Right.
Showed up to a working structure fire, and a couple people actually showed up in private vehicles first. And the guy who lit the house on fire is in the window with a hunting rifle taking out firefighters. West Webster, New York.
Yeah,
look
that was
up.
A few years ago, right?
I don't know. It was more than that. It was more than that. But anyway, it was crazy. You know, one of the guys, he was literally laying, bleeding out in the street, and a local farmer came through and dragged him out of there. And so, again, it's not new, but the prevalence, it's all around now. You know, I live in a town of less than 5,000 people is where I live. You know, it's not where I work, but it's less than 5,000 people. It's 26 square miles. It could happen here tomorrow. You know, there's a state park down the road that they've been closing because so many people are trying to get to hiking and swimming and stuff. But there's only so many parking spaces and, you know, social distancing, people are getting angry. They're coming in from the cities and they're getting angry because, well, my cousin's down there picnicking. There's no more parking spaces. Can't stay, you know. And they could get violent. But anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, right?
Let's move a little bit about away from wildland so we can move on and cut this a little shorter. And away from violence. What do you expect, initial radio report from your engine companies or truck companies where you were the deputy chief, Anthony? So what would you expect, number one, what they're thinking about in their mental size up, but what do you want to hear from them on the radios you're coming in a car or battalion chiefs coming in?
You mean for an incident of violence?
A structure
or just
fire.
We had a format. Our radio reports were very, very structured. They sounded the same all the time. As a matter of fact, the template is laminated and it's right on the dashboard of the rigs. And so they sounded the same all the time. I mean, I could still 5 years later recite them in my sleep. You know, so I
been retired exactly, 5 years.
Yeah, five and a half.
Wow.
Well, I knew exactly what what the report was going to sound like. So I knew, the most important thing about the report, that one, it should be standardized, and two, it should follow a linear sort of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way through, instead of, A, B, C, E, F, G, or A, G, F, B, Y, and it always sounds different. So, it's like in New York, in like Paterson, New Jersey, Jersey City, you hear this same continuous type of report. Engine 5 is on the scene at 305 Main Street. I have a 2.5-story wood frame residential occupancy. It's got a peaked roof. It's unattached on both sides. I have nothing shown. Engine 5 is investigating and establishing Main Street Command. Doesn't matter what it is, it's always going to sound that way. So, if there were things like, truss construction or someone hanging out a window, well, that would also be part of the report, an exposure imminently threatened, part of the initial report. But for the most part, it was always the same and gave you that information that, we can hang hooks on, like stretching a 2.5 or grabbing a lifeline as a ladder company, sticking a roof, whatever it happened to be. So we're very fortunate in that respect that we, it was almost like you didn't even have to think about it because it was very, very structured.
Cool. Now let's change it to a hazmat incident. You're dispatched to XYZ Corporation on 123 Main Street of 55-gallon drum leaking. What would you expect to hear from your first in company?
Well, at that point, I would expect to hear basically the same report, okay? But I would also then expect to hear some more preliminary information that, we will be, where they're going to be staging, where they're going to set up the command post, possibly asking for wind direction, something along those lines. Not committing themselves until they had a better idea of what was happening. And I would think most likely, unless there was something really going on, they would probably be staging and deferring any major decisions to the battalion chief coming in.
Okay.
They may call the hazmat. Sorry. They may call the hazmat squad immediately,
Yep.
Same with anything else, any other. That's what I would expect would have happened,
Yep. So, me being from a small department, I would expect that person company, first of all, isolating down an eye entry, like you said, stage a little bit, find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to ID the problem. What's really going on? And that's any size up. What's really going on? It's like you get dispatched to medical, sick. Well, don't assume because dispatch said sick that they're not having the big one. Or they dispatch you to a cardiac arrest. And the guy's sitting there talking to you. So, hazmat, what's the real problem? Is a 55-gallon drum of mineral oil leaking in their truck room you know, in their warehouse bay or something? Or is it something more serious? So they need to find somebody to tell them what's going on. So, again, we're a small department. We're all trained in hazmat. We don't have a hazmat team per se. It would be coming from further away. So we would have to do a lot of what. So you identify it as methylethyl bad shit. What are the risks? You know, evaluate what harm it can do if you don't do anything. Get information, figure out what's going on, and get the information out. Do we need a hazmat team, or do we just need a cleanup crew? You know, so we wouldn't wait for a hazmat team because we didn't have one. We had members on each shift that were part of the hazmat team that would be called in. But they would have to deal with it initially at first because it could take 40 minutes before we could get more help there. So, again, size up. What's going on? And I think that's important. Casey, on Wildlands, much similar. Kind of get a report from First In Companies, similar to what Chief Avillo said.
Yep, pretty close. We had, and I'm thinking back to well, probably the first real wildfire job I had was out in South Central Oregon there. We had a size-up card, a laminated card that would be, well, most of the time ours were reduced because we had to size everything down so it would fit in a radio harness on your chest. But it was essentially an exact duplicate of what dispatch had in front of them at the console at dispatch centers. And while you were talking, it kind of occurred to me, you know, we would go through that in the same process as they had it in front of them to make that easier for them to kind of, you know, take it down. You were saying in the same order that they needed to have it, but I can remember at first, you know, we were always, why do we have to tell them all this stuff? Why do we have to do all this stuff? And so as you were talking there, it made me kind of think of, well, who is this size up for? Who do you do that size up for? Do you do it for dispatch, or I mean, when you boil it right down, are those things that the things that you make them into a process? You make that into a what becomes second nature at some point. You know, Anthony said he could still recite it. You know, everything on that size up card from memory 5 years later. And it just makes me think of, you know, who you're getting that information for. Is it really for dispatch, or is it the things that you want every IC as they roll in on a new incident? Is it all those things that you want them to take a look at to make sure that they, you know, mentally, you know, it's a mental situation awareness kind of thing?
Yeah, it's for all the incoming units. If you show up and you say, you know, you're on an engine and you see someone hanging out of a window and your ground ladders on your engine aren't going to reach and the fire is too big for you to get in there. When you give that size up, the next in truck company or ladder company is going to know before they even arrive that they're going to be going to work and they're going to be setting up to do an exterior rescue. So, yeah, and I'm sure it's the same for, you know, the teams coming in and the crews coming in for a wildland firefighter. And again, I'm guessing because I have no experience in this.
Yeah.
Hey, Doc?
Yes, sir.
Hey, listen, my daughter just texted me. She's not really feeling good up at school. I want to give her a call before she goes to bed, okay?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Casey,
and you know
thank
what?
You, brother.
We'll sign off real quickly. And
no, you don't have to. You guys can continue if you need to. But, you know, I want to call her before because she's not feeling so good, and she's been sick the last week or so.
Well, give her my love.
Thank you. Casey, thank you, man.
You bet, man. Good talking to you.
As long as he's talking about his daughter, how's your family doing?
They are doing good. We have a seventh grader in the house now, which is hard to believe, but it's a little different, obviously. You know, they're doing the hybrid thing, so they're going to school 2 days out of five, and the other 3 days here at home in Mrs. McCoy's seventh grade class, but I actually refer to it fondly as Mrs. McCoy's seventh grade class and hair care center, but
good. I'm glad they're all doing well. I see you post pictures of her every once in a while, you know,
every so often, yeah,
doing something, and I think that's great. They're you know what, and it's something I've always tried to say and live to the guys I work with and to myself, that they're the most important thing. You know, even as I struggled to get promoted, you know, I always tried to make sure I took care of my home life and let my bride know that, you know, she was still important. And, you know, although sometimes she didn't always believe it, you know, I think a couple of times she may even have said to me, why don't you just marry the goddamn fire department, you know, but they're important. No matter how involved you get in all this stuff we're just talking about, and I've always been pretty involved, make sure they know. And obviously I see your posts sometimes, and I'm sure your daughter knows that she's important. But
yeah.
But anyway, we usually do about an hour and a half. And anything you want to add about sizing up of a wildfire, anything that I missed or you missed in wildland stuff?
No, I think we've actually, like I said, listening to you guys talk, it's you know, it's like we're not looking at the same things, but we're looking at them, I think, for the same reasons. How to build that better picture of what you've got in front of you, and how to paint that better picture of, you know, to the folks that are back in dispatch, in command, the next Indian companies, to try to picture for them. So you're building out their, picture when they get on scene. One of the things that I was used to, I'm reverting back to my training guy days, when we would get on this topic in wildfire classes, I always would give them a trick question, which, maybe it was just me thinking I was cuter than I was, but I always ask them, wildfires have one advantage, and that is size up can start very early. And I said, why do I say that? I would ask them, why do I say size up can start very early? And I get a lot of blank stares, which is common in the class. Something to think about. Not that a lot. But my point being that you can size up tomorrow's wildfire tonight when you're watching the 10 o'clock news. You get that, you know, about 10, 15 minutes in, you get a weather forecast of what tomorrow's going to do. Granted, it may not be a quote, a fire behavior forecast, but it may not be that detailed. But, you know, you can listen for things like the humidity is going to drop, the wind's going to be going, you know, 10 to 15, gusting to 30, out of this direction. And so you can kind of, you can't get specific on a location, but you get a lot of those general things about starting to plan. Okay, if we do get something tomorrow, if we do have a wildfire that starts for whatever reason, we already know based on the weather forecast that we just got that it has the potential, or the other side of that, we know that we can maybe, I don't want to say drag our feet, but we don't have to go 9,000 miles an hour to get to a fire on a day that it's 75% humidity and, you know, 56 degrees necessarily. The wind's only blowing 5 miles an hour or less. We can maybe be a little bit more deliberate in how we do things and raise that level of safety as you're going to that incident. So that's one advantage, I think, that maybe not necessarily the folks that go into structure fires might have quite as well, as the guys on the wildfire side have.
I'm gonna stop you there because, especially in a department like mine where we ran a dual service, we were the EMS provider, so everybody that works there was a paramedic, or it had to be for the first 10 years on a job. After that, they could drop it. But every bed, you have an opportunity to look around. Where are the staircases? Where are the windows? Where are the bedrooms? So every call you go on, you could be doing a pre-plan mentally, even if it's not a formal one. But if you realize that you have to go up the back stairs to get to the apartment on the third floor, you would know that. Well, hopefully you would know that because everybody doesn't pay attention. But if you showed up at that fire at 2 o'clock in the morning, so I was here for a medical last month or last year, and I remember that to get to the third floor, you have to go to the back staircase, and you can't get there from the front staircase. So there's a lot you can do as you drive around. as you call, you notice where the hydrants are and things like that. But I definitely always try to tell the guys when they go to medicals, look around. You know, what's going on? Is it a hoarder house? Is it a mess? Is there stuff all over the place? You know, you're looking at how people live. It makes a difference at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're crawling up a staircase. You know, so, yeah, you could do that as well. I never thought of it on the wildland side, the weather, like you just said. And I don't even know, is there a line or something that you consider a favorable humidity where you're less concerned on a general basis, even on a bigger wildfire?
Yeah, it's kind of relative to wherever you're at. That, you know, like when I was out in Oregon, you know, when you get below 30% humidity, that was kind of a heads up for us. I mean, you could still get fires when it was above that, but above 30%, it wasn't going well. You never say never, right? But generally, when it was below 30% was when you kind of had a heads up. When it got down in the teens, you even got more heads up. And out there, that happens in the summertime. That happens on a pretty regular basis. And then that, what would that have been? That would have been the summer of 97, I think. I get the Wayback Machine out again. 97 or 98, when they sent us to Florida on one of the summers they were trying to burn the whole state up. And
I remember,
you know,
that.
It was an interesting, they flew us down there with our engine, which was an interesting, in the belly of an Air Force C-5. It was a heck of a trip. But I don't think the whole time we were down there that the humidity ever got below 30%, but the fuels that they had, and for them, it was dry. It was a very eye-opening thing down there to be looking at fuels that were, from my perspective in Oregon, would never burn. And then you'd watch them burn right in front of you. And you're like, oh, that's interesting to see that happen right in front of you. So it's, yeah, like I said, it's a long roundabout answer. 30% is kind of a general rule of thumb a lot of times, and it doesn't fit everywhere. But it's kind of, you know, depending on where you're at, it's a pretty solid rule of thumb anyway.
See, again, I learned something tonight, so I'm pretty happy. no, seriously. So do you ever get to Les Lucard anymore? Or is that all too far away for you to get to?
Yeah, I haven't. I have not. I would like to. It was, it's a heck of a nice little school to go down to. But no, we're probably, from here, we're probably pushing 9 hours away. So I have not gone back down there. We left the state.
Yeah, I have to say, the folks who are listening, if you're in the Midwest anywhere, the Les Lucard Winter Conference is a great conference to go to. I've been last few years, actually maybe up to 5 years, I've been going to the Missouri Winter Fire School, and that's been a lot of fun too. But I just think the down home feeling and the families being involved at Les, thing very, very special that I don't see in many conferences I attend. You know, I'm thinking of putting it in for not next year because I'm already committed, but the year after, just to see if I could go back, you know, one more time. I just think something they do reminds me of my old volunteer days. You know, there was always a dinner to go to, a potluck dinner or something, where the volunteers got together on a very social basis. Which I think we're starting to lose in the fire service these days. Everybody's too busy, you know, and so wrapped up in so many other things. But that still had that hometown feel to it, even though it was broader than that. But I always felt I was going to a local volunteer firehouse for especially their Saturday night dinner that they did. I thought that was so nice.
Yeah, and that was something we just I honestly don't remember. We started that when, I think it was when Shane and I were the president and vice president, but I don't remember quite why we did. I think it was a great thing to start. And that's going to sound a lot like patting myself on the back or something there, but, but I think, you know, something that, we, you know, to do just what you said, to get people to, to come and go back to that sharing of information across from one fire department to the next, that you sometimes miss. And, you know, I love going to FDIC. I mean, that's like, I have not been there now since 2016, which is too long. But that definitely has its own, you know, feel about it. It's like a big fire. I call it a big firefighter circus or firefighter carnival.
Yeah. It is incredible.
Lots of candy for firefighters. But it's definitely different than, you know, going to stuff like the Les Lukert conference. It's just a, well, we tried to go out of our way. You guys were the stars that came to that. We were just so impressed that we were able to get, you know, instructors of your caliber to come to things like that. And maybe that was, we were a bit in awe of you guys. So we wanted to, make you feel like it was worth your time to come and show you as good a time as we could anyway. And maybe that's just Nebraskans in general too. I'm really biased in that respect. They're just,
you know, what it may be. And what I think's really good about it, and it's the same thing where I was a volunteer on Long Island, that the families got to see what you were involved in. My wife, your kid, whoever, they come and they're the ones who sit. You run out, you get an alarm, your pager goes off, and you run out the door. But then they get to come to a dinner with other firefighter families and enjoy themselves. They see who you are and what you're involved with. And I think that's important too, because the family is part of it. But anyway, don't put us up on a pedestal. We just like talking. We love the fire service and we like talking and we want to share the knowledge. And that's really what it comes down to. You know what? I see the world from my little point of view. You see it from your little point of view. You've shared so much with us tonight. And I'm just going to ask you, in conclusion or in closing, do you have anything you'd like to add to say out there to our listeners tonight?
Covered a lot of ground, I think. How
about a summary?
I'm thinking.
I'm sorry, I put you on the spot, but.
No, that's all right. No, I think it's important for firefighters that you mentioned something earlier. I think perspective is really important. There are a lot of similarities between wildfire and structure fire, obviously similarities, but they're not the same. I think as if you find yourself, you know, like now as we have engines of more, I won't say purely structural guys, but more structural fire oriented folks being sent from Minnesota out to Oregon to fight fire. I think it's understanding that when you get into a situation like that, something outside of your slide set, you don't have a mental slide in your set to deal with something like that, that understanding that it's okay to ask questions once you get into something like that. It's maybe not as unfamiliar as you might think it might be going into something like that. I was always amazed when I moved from Oregon to Kansas, the difference in perspectives of those people about, you know, the people in Oregon, when I told them I was moving to Kansas, they went, "Oh my God, those are grass fires. They just move like crazy. Those guys are crazy fighting those fires." And I got to Kansas and the Kansas guys, "Hey, you came from Oregon, man, those guys are crazy out there fighting those big timber fires." And so I think perspective is important to keep in mind, and don't be afraid to ask questions. If you have questions, ask them. And, you know, it's another cliche, but there is no such thing as a dumb question other than the one you don't ask.
You're absolutely correct. And conclusion, all I'm going to say is keep your eyes open, watch your butt, watch your brother's butt, your sister's butt, and be careful. It's not always what it seems. And stay safe. And I do also have to say thank you again to our sponsors, Globe, MSA Safety, Athletics. And I think they're doing a great job. They help finance this so we can do these shows on almost a daily basis. and we appreciate their help. And Casey, I appreciate you coming to speak to us. It was a pleasure, and you stay safe. Till next time.
Thank you, Jim. You too.